This is Arthur Adams, and you're listening to the Cave of Solitude. Enjoy.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the megacity metropolis of Toronto. I am your host, Eric Anthony, and I am proud to present to you part two of the John Byrne Spotlight, coming to you from this year's Fan Expo Canada 2018. I had the privilege of sitting in on two panels this year, and of course, it's a rare treat to have John Byrne appear at Comic Cons at all. In this day and age, and he said himself during this particular panel that you're about to listen to that this would be his final panel ever. That's what John Byrne says himself in the beginning of this panel. So how could I be sitting on this material and not be able to share it with the fans, fanboys, fangirls alike, who have followed this man's career, some of us from our childhood, and some who are discovering it for the first time if they're getting into the comic book medium as readers now. So you might hear some questions, because this is a Sunday panel. The one that I posted for you guys before was a Saturday panel. So this is the last day of Fan Expo Canada 2018 on the Sunday. I sat in on this panel with good friend of the show, Martin Slam Duncan, who you'll hear ask a question near the beginning of the recording. But some of the questions may seem redundant, and you'll think to yourself, have I heard this? Didn't someone ask that yesterday? Possibly yes. But there are a lot of stories and anecdotes that only add to some of the things you may have heard that are repeated. And of course, there are original questions. I had the opportunity to ask a few myself, which I was really privileged to do, because again, I'll never know when we'll encounter John Byrne at a con again. So without further ado, this is episode 132, a spotlight on John Byrne at Fan Expo Canada 2018, part two.
So I think we're going to do the same thing we did yesterday, which is prepare nothing and hope you guys carry us through the panel. So let's just do a Q&A. This is probably John's last Canadian panel, if not...
My last ever, anywhere. Yeah.
What?
I had a good time at this con, but it reminds me why.
All right.
I'm old. I'm really old.
Sir?
So, question about... So, Alpha Flight. So... So many characters were just different. So, like, first time, so, like, with North Star, his sexuality, Roger Box being a paraplegic, an indigenous character. Why? Can you talk about that? What was the inspiration?
Why were they all different?
Well, when I think of Marvel, I think of it being the kind of the oddball guys who become the superheroes back in the day. You know, Peter Parker, who's the nerdy kid, and Don Blake, who's the, and we use the word cripple these days, I don't think he's differently abled back. And, you know, just in general, I mean, the Fantastic Four were these straight-up normal people to get superpowers. And I wanted Alpha Flight to be different. I'd already created Guardian. I created Guardian in my fan days, so he was, you know, Mr. Square Jaw, Mr. Big Chest. But I wanted the others, like Puck and Roger Box and one or two of the others, to just be different, you know, and just say, look, you can be different, and you can be a superhero. You can have no legs, and you can be a superhero. So, why not? Yeah.
Yes, sir. With all your extensive work at Marvel and DC, are there any characters you would have liked to have written for that you never got the chance to?
Well, I got to write just about everybody as guest stars. But whenever that question is asked, the one that comes immediately to mind that I might have liked to play with in series form is Doctor Strange. I think he would have been fun. Yeah. Yeah. Sir? Oh, how do I build a page, basically, yeah. Back in the day, when I was just starting out, before I really got into the business, And I heard artists did thumbnails and then layouts, and da da da. So I would do thumbnails, and then I didn't have an artograph, so I'd blow them up in my mind, and put them on the page, and do layouts, and then I'd do finished pencils, and then I'd ink it. And then one day I said, I'm drawing this page like 4 or 5 times. What am I doing here? So I started doing my thumbnails full size on the page. So the first thing, I lay out the panel shapes. And then I draw the perspective grid for those panels that need perspective grids. And then I draw the figures on the perspective grid. And then I do the backgrounds around the figures. So, you know, always telling myself to leave the top third of the panel not empty, but unimportant, so you can cover it with copy.
When you were doing books like Superman or Fantastic Four, how much did you write for yourself versus just sort of jumping in and drawing?
Well, mostly, yeah. When I'm writing for myself, I mostly start with the art. This X-Men thing that I deny. You know, I just started drawing it one day, and I drew a page, and I drew another page, and I drew another one. And the other day, it's now got more than 20 pages. I don't know why. And I realized I hadn't started scripting it seriously yet. I thought, oh, that's going to be a lot of scripting and ballooning and all that stuff. So it's the Star Trek book was interesting too, because, you know, that was building out of existing pictures. So I would do that, and then I would script it as I went along. So each page was scripted as I went, and then I'd get to page 14 and realize, oh, I've got to change what I wrote on page 12 because it doesn't fit. And that's the wonder that is Photoshop. You know, I love the wonder that is Photoshop. And I'm even getting some use with this non-existent X-Men book. Because if it was ever real and if it was ever inked, it would be done, it would be inked on blue line. Do you know what that is? You know, where the art is reproduced in blue, a non-reproducible blue. And I realized that means I'm never sending the pencils in. Which gives me the opportunity to use Photoshop. Like the story you've seen online has a lot of jungle in it. And I looked at it, well, I didn't do very well with this jungle right here. But I did it much better 10 pages later. So I'm going to clone that over here and flop it, you know. And then when the inker inks it, it won't look the same. You know? So I've never used Photoshop on pencils before. It's really a kind of an interesting experience. I actually transplanted, on one page, I transplanted Nightcrawler's face. I took a big face and put it on a smaller figure in another panel because it worked better. Uh-huh. And I said, oh yeah, this is great. Someday I won't have to draw anything.
Hi. Hi. What was your favorite comic project and why?
Favorite comic project? Well, that's a broad spectrum because I derived pleasure from most, though not all, of the things I did. I think my best work, just my technically best work, is OMAC. The thing I probably had the most fun with, though, was Batman and Captain America. Although that, I want to go back and re-ink that. I was going through a thing with my inks. Now I look at it and go, oh, no, I'm going to turn into George Lucas.
Are you able to, say today, recall a style of your inking from a different era?
Well, I'm aware of it, yes. And there was one commission piece that somebody asked me to do a Hulk figure in the style that it was originally done. And it scared the bejeebers out of me doing it because I thought, oh, God, what if I stick? What if I'm drawing like 1977, and I can't stop drawing like it's 1977. But I've gone 40 years.
You're strange. Draw like the guy you used to be.
Draw like the guy I used to be, yeah. It's somebody online, you know, talking about the non-existent X-Men books. And, you know, get Terry to ink it, but get him to ink it like he did, and Terry will appreciate that. No, yeah.
So what point in your career do you feel like you were most comfortable doing your own pencils and inks?
Not yet. No, I always hope that day is coming. But, yeah, there'll be times. Well, I talked about it online, where every once in a while, I'll finish a page and I'll kind of say, "Damn, I'm good," and I call these my "Damn, I'm good" days because they don't happen very often. You know, if it happened a lot, I'd call it Tuesday. But I say, every once in a while, I can kind of sit back and say, "Oh, I think I understand what the people like," because here it is. Yeah, and it's usually some goofy thing that has some minor element that doesn't really not an exploding planet. I talked years ago. There was a shot in Next Men where Jasmine, you know, we're realizing that she's pregnant. And she's in the ladies' room throwing up, and I did a thing. And the hand was the most perfect hand I've ever drawn. You know? And I thought, it was one of those moments where I should just stop now. You know, because it's never going to get any better than this. Yes, next. All right.
How long does it take you to do a painting? Can you tell us something about the time you were out of life?
How long does it take me to do a page? How do I structure my day? Well, back in the day when I was doing Fantastic Four and Alpha Flight at the same time, I was doing 3 pages a day of finished pencils, or of pencils and inks. And each page took about 2 hours. Now, how many of you have seen the non-existent X-Men book online? Okay. Go look at it, the rest of you, on my portfolio, my forum. Because those pages have been coming out of my pencil at the rate of 1 per hour.
Oh.
What?
Which blows my mind.
Don't tell Marvel that.
Yeah.
It's a weekly comic.
Yeah.
If it ever becomes a comic.
There's no announcement. And even I'm boggled by that. I mean, I would sit there and draw like I normally do. That's nice. Look at the clock. Oh, that took an hour. You know. Oh. Now, I have said that I think it's because a lot of the panels are full of what I call Zen jungle, which is where you just...
there's a jungle.
Okay. If I was drawing cityscapes and strange spaceships and things like that, it would probably take longer. But my average speed is 2 hours for full pencils or 2 hours for pencils and inks, because I don't do finished pencils when I ink myself. Which is one of the reasons I did this particular X-Men thing in full pencils, because I hadn't done that in so long. I wanted to see if I could still do it. Yeah. Sir?
Hi. I was wondering, for the Alpha Flight characters, were they based on people that you knew? Like, how did you come up with all the personalities?
Well, there was only one character in Alpha Flight who was a real person, and that was Gary Cody, who ran Department S, and he's sitting right here.
Oh, cool.
Stand up, dude.
Hey.
He looks a little older than he did 38 years ago. But the rest of them, no, were just people who popped into my head. I think I'd say Guardian was a fan character. I created Guardian sometime around 1972, 73. And then the rest of them, really, I designed simply to survive a fight with the X-Men. And then they turned out to be hugely popular, and Marvel wanted to give them their own book, and I resisted it for a long time. And then when I finally relented and said, all right, we'll do their own book, and I sat down and said, who the hell are these people? They have to have personalities. And that's why I have often said that North Star was gay from day 2. Because he wasn't gay when I created him, but he was gay when I needed something to make him 3-dimensional. And then, of course, Jim Shooter said, yeah, you can make him gay, but you can't say it in the book. But I seem to have managed to get the message somehow. Yeah.
So when you left the book, and you did the whole Hulk switch, was that your choice? Had you gone as far as you wanted?
Yeah, I see... Alpha Flight was never real to me because it wasn't created by Stan and Jack or, you know, Stan and Steve. These were just stupid fan characters. Who cares? And I tried to make them real in my own mind, but the only real characters were ones that I read as a kid. So I went to Bill Mantlo one day and said, you want a trade? And he did, and then he did some odd things.
You mentioned shooter. How much control did you try to exert over your parts? All of it?
Shooter had what had, has, what I call the whim of iron. It almost seemed literally like he'd come in on Monday morning with a new idea, and we all had to follow it until he forgot it the next week because he had another new idea. I mean, one of the main reasons Roger Stern and I quit Captain America was because Shooter came in one day and said, everything has to be one-issue stories. And we said, okay, you know, we're just starting a three-parter, but as soon as we're done, we'll do one-issue stories. And he said, no, now. I said, well, I've drawn 6 pages of this first issue. We can't fit the next, you know, 3 issues into what's left of the book. So we got huffy and quit. And that was in the days when the fans still supported me when I quit. He must have done it for a good reason. I said, I'll burn Neverlast more than 8 issues.
So then Fantastic Four, because you came on just about at the 20th anniversary.
5 issues before.
Yeah, and then you left right before the 25th anniversary.
The 300th issue.
Wasn't really my intent.
Was that, yeah, what was the history there?
Well, I was having fun working on the Fantastic Four. I was looking for a bit of a break. And I had been talking to John Romita Jr. about drawing it while I wrote it. And we were kind of cruising towards that. I think that would be fun. And then I accepted the Superman gig. And in my innocence, I assumed I would do Superman and the Fantastic Four. But as soon as Shooter found out about Superman, suddenly nothing I was doing on the Fantastic Four was any good. It had to keep getting changed, it had to do this, it had to do that. And I said to Mike Carlin, who was my editor then, I said, you know, I'm gonna just leave because you shouldn't have to put up with this shit just because I'm going to go do Superman. Now, Mike Hobson, who was the publisher at Marvel in those days, he congratulated me and said, on Superman and said, anything that's good for DC will be good for Marvel. It'll be good for the whole industry.
Yeah.
Not Shooter. So I left, and then Shooter fired Carlin because it was his fault. I left.
Can't do Leto and Letterman.
I guess not. I was so innocent and naive. It's probably the last days of my genuine innocence.
What?
Okay, so now, with Shooter being so hard on the creative teams, sometimes restrictions help you be more creative to try to work around it. Let's just say now this X-Men thing, you don't have any oversight right now because it is just for fun.
Mm-hmm.
But do you impose your own story restrictions now?
Oh, absolutely. And sort of do I edit myself kind of thing? Yeah, you know, I mean, I always try to make sense of what I do, I guess is the best way to say it. I try not to be too crazy. There are points. Well, for example, this non-existent X-Men book, which I have said, because it's the what if Phoenix hadn't died storyline. And I said, obviously a lot of people are going to interpret that as a to Shooter. But I'm working very hard to make sure it doesn't read that way. You know, but if it does in fact become something real and runs for, you know, 100 issues, there'd be no point at which you could say, oh, well, that's where he's thumbing his nose at Shooter. So, but I'm sure everyone will be able to read subtext. And, oh, look, he's making fun of Claremont. No, it's just a guy with a beard walking down the street. No, it's fine. It was a funny thing, parenthetically, when I did the Santa Claus issue of She-Hulk. Remember that? Nick St. Christopher. And Chris was convinced it was supposed to be him.
It's Santa.
Okay.
You mentioned Stan and Jack
I just wondered what kind of influence those early Marvel books had on you. When were you, how old were you, and what did they do to your brain?
Well, I was, I had actually read Fantastic Four number 2 in the barber shop. I'd read a coverless issue in the barber shop, waiting to get my brush cut. And then the first one I bought was FF5, as I think everybody knows by now. And I would say, without hesitation, that I, as you know me, would not exist if not for that first 3 or 4 years of Marvel that I read, you know, the burgeoning days of Marvel. I mean, God in heaven, what a time. You know, I picked up Fantastic Four number 5, and almost before I could turn around, there was the Avengers, the X-Men, you know, Thor, Spider-Man, boom, 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 all these first issues. I missed Amazing Fantasy 15, but I did get Spider-Man number 1. And it was like a revelation because the DC characters had been fine, and I had fun with them, and I enjoyed them. And then when Marvel came along, I suddenly realized how bland they were. How, you know, Superman was always fighting bank robbers and, you know, things like that. The Fantastic Four were fighting Doctor Doom. I mean, Doctor Doom was in Fantastic Four number 5, my first issue. And it was also a time travel story, so right away I'm sucked right in, you know. But yeah, those first years, I got a whole bunch of, about 40 pages of Jack's art from that period, and I have it hanging in what I call the Kirby corner of my studio, KK Kirby corner. And I sometimes will just stand there and go, wow, wow. I told this story yesterday, I think, about Jim Warden, my art dealer, came to my house with his son, who was celebrating his 13th birthday. And I pointed out to him that one of the pages I had was a page from Strange Tales Annual number 2, which I bought on my 13th birthday. And I said, imagine if I could go back in time to my 13-year-old self and say, someday you are going to own a page from that book. And my 13-year-old self would say, but I own the whole thing. I just paid a quarter for it.
I was wondering, what do you think of all the superhero films, and do you have a favorite, and what character would you like to see brought to life?
I thought the first Iron Man movie was really good. It actually eclipsed Superman the movie as my favorite superhero movie. Most of them, I think, suck. They're just so far off model, and they're all Mr. Director showing us his vision. And I just sit there saying, I'd actually rather see Stan Lee's vision, if you don't mind, you know, as he, Steve Ditko's vision, as it was laid out originally. Although there have been moments. I thought there was like a 6-minute trailer for Captain America, the first, you know, the first Avenger. And I thought that was the best Captain America movie I've ever seen, that 6-minute trailer. You had to squint because, you know, they messed up the costumes. But then, of course, they had to have, in the actual movie, that USO scene where they mock the actual costume. Yeah. And, of course, you know, Bryan Singer gave us the yellow spandex line, thanks a lot. I brought this up yesterday. I said, how many of you can name characters, superheroes, who wear spandex? Who actually wear spandex? Maybe Spider-Man, because it's homemade. Christopher Reeve wore spandex in the movie, but that's not what it is in the comic. They don't. I mean, I've seen reviews where they have, like, it's obviously a multiple function key that automatically types spandex clad, and they use it to refer to Iron Man, you know. And I go, well, no. It's not iron, I grant you, but it isn't spandex either, guys. Come on. And Superman's costume is made of this, and you know, the Fantastic Four have their unstable molecules, and according to Chris, Professor Xavier bought a whole bunch of unstable molecule material to make the X-Men costumes. So, you know, nobody wears spandex. I did cause a furor online a few years ago when I suggested that Luke Cage's pants were spandex. Yeah. For some reason, people got upset about that. You know, I'm guessing Thor doesn't wear spandex, you know? Yes.
When you're assigned or when you take on a book series or a character, how do you structure out story? Like, are you led by the images you want to create? Are you plot things out on cue cards? Like, how do you...
Well, first of all, the way my head works, this non-existent X-Men book, I drew a splash page just as a test. And then I drew another splash page. And then because of the way my brain works, I had a whole issue in my head before I was anywhere. This is something Howard Mackey figured out years ago when he was my editor. He'd call up and say, you don't have any Iron Man stories, do you? And the next day I'd call him back and say, you son of a bitch. Now I've got three Iron Man stories in my head with nowhere to put them. Howard can tell other editors, you know, how to do that. So the stories come pretty fast and pretty furious. And it's 62 years of reading comics creates this thing, this monster, this Cthulhu monster in my head that generates stories. So, Superman.
So when you were like basically running the Namor series, like where he's presented as like this corporate tycoon, was that actually your idea, or was that one of the editorial?
No, that was how they presented it to me. Do you want to do Namor as a corporate tycoon? And I thought, well, that's cool. I mean, he's sort of been that, you know, since Stan and Jack brought him back. He's owned companies and done stuff like that. So that seemed like an interesting way to take him to a level we don't normally go to. And it turned out to be a lot of fun.
What led to the art experimentation that you started playing with, you know, like you got in the series that all the
Duochade? The Duochade? I was messing around with Duochade. I think was Namor the first place I used it?
Because I remember seeing it.
Yeah, but this was back before we had computer coloring and we were still, you know, the four-color process, and so I was looking for ways to give tone and depth and whatnot.
You've done extensive work in both companies, Marvel and DC. What did you find were the differences in how you approach those characters and the rules that you have to abide by with them?
I'll tell you a funny story. When I left DC and I went back to Marvel, and I was doing West Coast Avengers, and I had an issue that opened with a scene of Hawkeye out on the practice range firing his arrows. And I drew him standing there firing his arrows, and I said, oh, come on. Braced it, put him on this whirly-dig machine that's throwing him around, and he's firing and still hitting bullseyes. And I said, that seemed more Marvel. And I mentioned that to Walt Simonson. And Walt said, that's what you should have been doing at DC. I said, yeah, there was a different mindset. The minute I stepped through the door at DC, everything went down a few hundred notches. You know, it was like what Stan used to say, in Marvel Comics, people don't reach for the phone. They reach for the phone. it's true, you know, you don't come in through a door, you're coming through the door. That was the biggest difference, just this little psychological. DC is calmer. Well, of course, I've often said, set aside which characters are your favorites and all that, which universe would you want to live in? You know, because the DC universe has Superman, and the Marvel universe has Galactus. You know, so which universe would you want to live in? I think I'd want to live in the DC universe, because it's so much safer.
At the time, many artists were drawing female characters, sort of like the same person with a different wig. Your women looked like individuals. Was that something you were intentional
with? That was very important to me. Thank you for noticing. When I was doing She-Hulk, I got a lot of letters from girlfriends of fans. And they would say, you know, my boyfriend reads She-Hulk, and I look at it, and what I really like is, even though she's got gigantic boobs, They move like real gigantic boobs. what I call the flow, you know, so they're not cannon mounted to your chest. But also, I've only ever created two female characters who were deliberately busty, and one was Aurora, and the other was Bethany in X-Men. The rest of them I try to draw, well, I give them different figures, the same way I give the male different figures. And I think that's important, but I don't like these cookie-cutter physiques.
So along those lines, and She-Hulk, and I guess in every book you've done, how much studying of fashion do you do to sort of nail your outfits?
When I was doing Fantastic Four and Avengers and Superman, I had a subscription to Vogue, so I could flip through and say, what are the ladies wearing or think they're wearing right now? And when I was playing with this X-Men thing, I sat down and looked at some current fashions, because this is another book like Hidden Years, that if it happened, it will be set in the past, but it will happen now. You know, so the tropes would be modern. So I was looking at modern fashions, thinking, well, you know, when they're in their street clothes, how will Kitty dress? How will Storm dress? And that was one of the things that used to annoy me when I worked at Marvel and DC. I would kind of, not literally, but I feel like I was storming through the halls going, for Christ's sake, go buy a Cosmopolitan. You know, come on. Women don't all dress like sluts.
So when you resubscribe to Vogue now, that's when you'll know this X-Men book.
Yeah, that's when you know it's real. Yeah. I mean, I remember seeing an issue of Fantastic Four where they're on the beach or something, and there's Sue in this micro bikini with a pierced navel. And I said, micro bikini and pierced navel is fine, but not Sue. You know, Sue is an elegant lady. Dress her elegantly. You know, maybe Kitty would have a micro bikini. She's 14, my Kitty, so. But yeah, I just kind of want to be aware of the real world. That was another thing that was appealing about early Marvel to me, was that it was very much recognizably the real world. I was reading those early issues of Fantastic Four, and they took place in New York. They didn't take place in Gotham or Metropolis or Central City. They were in New York. And I remember, I was kind of a naive kid, okay, but I remember really thinking, is this just stuff that I'm not seeing on the news? You know, is this real? And especially when Stan and Jack did that, you know, a day at the Marvel offices thing, you know, where Dr. Doom comes in and all that stuff. It really convinced me that it was real. And I'll tell you something else, even though I used the phrase. A little part of me died the first time I heard the phrase Marvel Universe. Because I said, okay, they're saying it's not us. It's not our world. It's another world, a different world. And that was one of the most important sub-psychological things about Marvel, was that they played it as if it was the world outside your window. And suddenly that went away. And then you get, you know, multiple universes and all that, and I say, well, who cares? Why do I care if the Fantastic Four get killed? Because there's a billion other Fantastic Fours who are exactly the same. So, yeah. That's just me being grumpy. Sir in the blue shirt, is it blue?
Yeah. What were the conversations with you like as a creator before that relaunch about the renumbering and what they wanted out of you as a creator?
Oh, sure, yeah. When I went off contract at Marvel, Dick Giordano called me immediately and said, okay, you know, you've been bitching about Superman for years. Put your money where your mouth is. And let me add parenthetically that I wish I had said no. But I said yes, and got together with Dick and Jeanette and Paul Levitz, and talked about stuff, and I came up with what I called my list of unreasonable demands. And it was about 20 points. And they accepted most of them. They said, yeah, you can do this. You know, Superman is once again the sole survivor of the doomed planet Krypton. That's kind of important, I think. I wanted to make Ma and Pa Kent younger, so it was more reasonable that he was their kid. They didn't have to pretend they got him from their cousin in Milwaukee or something. I wanted to emphasize that it is the man that is important, not the super. And I also wanted to make Clark Kent more dynamic. My favorite Clark Kent is George Reeves. I've often said, you know, you watch that show and Lois will come in and go, oh, Clark, no, oh, something horrible is happening. And he'll just go, oh, get off my case, Lois, I'm working. And then she leaves and he goes. And he was such a dynamic. That means having two namics. He was a very dynamic Clark. He wasn't a wimpy Clark. Although I've said many times, Christopher Reeve convinced me that disguise works. That you can part your hair on the other side and slouch and wear a pair of glasses and look like a different guy. I mean, I'm sure you all remember the scene where he comes to Lois's apartment after Superman has flown her around, and Clark comes to take her out on a date, and he's standing there, and she's gone into the bedroom to change, and he looks at the bedroom door, and he kind of goes, takes off the glasses, and he stands up like another 6 inches. And then she comes up, and he puts the glasses back on. But he really convinced me that you could do it. If you sold it properly, you could do it. So that was a lot of what I brought to it. And I also wanted Lois to not be a bitch. Because she was... Margot Kidder made me understand why Superman would be smitten with Lois, because up until then I just, what is this? You know, I remember the Superman parody I did in What the? And it was Park Bench and Nosy Dame were their names. And I also wanted Lana Lang to be a more important character. I felt she got short shirt. Because, of course, when Superboy was created, the character, the comic, the Superman editorial office ignored it for like 10 years. They just pretended the Superboy comic didn't exist. So this whole thing was going on with Lana, and if you were reading that independently, you'd go, well, obviously he's going to grow up and marry Lana, right? But for years in Superman, obviously he's going to marry Lois, right? And so when the first time they brought Lana into a Superman story, she was this cold, hard, sort of vaguely Katharine Hepburn-like character. And I'm like, no, she's Lana Turner, guys, come on. Or, you know, Lana Turner with red hair. I wanted to get into the history and the background and build the characters from the ground up with a more, I hate to use the word, but a more realistic approach. How can you be realistic with, you know, a guy who can fly? But yeah, I hope that answers the question. I kind of rambled for a bit there. Sir?
Oh, you did a Forge World book, something?
Yes.
Design-wise, was it hard, you know, to get heavy characters like you have to start feeling hard?
Oh, I think I know what you're asking. The first time I ever read, New Gods, I guess, was the first one I ever read when it first came out. I had missed the first issue. So I started reading it with the second issue, and the second issue has that whole sequence, there came a time when the old gods died. And I read that with this double-page spread of Armageddon and all this kind of crap. I read that, pardon my French, fuck, what was in the first issue? Which I ultimately tracked down, but that stuff just blew me away. You know, that was one of those worlds that I just fell into and went, wow. And then how many years later DC says, you want to do the new guns? We've got to do Fourth World, and we're going to put all those books together. And I go, so I can do the New Gods and the Forever People and Mr. Miracle all in one book? I'm there. Mm-hmm. Present, you know. So yeah, that was a lot of fun. And you know, Fourth World was a lot of fun. Wonder Woman was a lot of fun. I could have done 100 issues of either one of those. But the editor told me one day that he was going to be leaving DC. And I was very close to the end of my contract. And I said, oh God, I could re-sign for a year and end up with some Nazi as my new editor. You know, do I want to do that? Do I want to risk being trapped for a year on these books that I love, but with some editor who doesn't get them, you know, or whatever? So I left. I left both the books. And then the editor didn't leave DC. Thanks a lot. But, you know, it's one of those things that I almost feel like I would still be doing The New Gods today if that hadn't happened, because there was just so much. What? Okay. No, you shut up. You shut up. I'm going to go to you with the blue t-shirt. Yeah.
You mentioned that the characters of Alpha Flight didn't seem real to you because they weren't Stan and Jack characters. Just wondering if over the years have your opinions changed on that, and if so, if you have any opinion on where the characters have or haven't gone since then.
Well, I'll admit I haven't been crazy about where they've gone. One of my least favorite moments is North Star outing himself by yelling, I am gay, in the middle of a fight. And of course, you know, they gave Puck, or they gave Roger Box's legs back, and they made Puck 6 or 4, and it was kind of like, wow, you sat down and you figured everything you could possibly do wrong, and you did that. But ultimately, I've had to train myself not to care. You know, because when you let go, you have to let go. A somewhat recent example is what they did to Cassie Sandsmark in Wonder Woman once I left. And you know, I'd done this kind of all elbows and knees, you know, 14-year-old girl, and they turned her into Britney Spears. And that's because there's an awful lot of artists out there, sadly, male, who can only draw Britney Spears. You know, they can't understand. And there's an awful lot of fans who won't accept anything else. I got a lot of mail saying how ugly Cassie was. And I said, she's not ugly, she's ordinary. You guys are just used to seeing these cookie cutter whatnots. I've forgotten what the question was. What was the question?
Oh, just regarding Alpha Flight, just if your opinions.
Oh, yeah, no, they weren't real. And they haven't become real. But if they ever make an Alpha Flight movie, I'll be happy to take the money.
I have a question about your early part of your career and how you got started at Charlton
College. Yeah. How did I get started at Charlton?
Yeah.
I had done a Raj 2000 strip for CPL Fanzine, and Nick Cuddy, who was an editor and a writer at Charlton, saw it and liked it and asked me if I would not like to do it as a backup in E-Man. And then they saw how fast I was and said, wow, you want to do a couple of real books? You want to do Space 1999? You know, you want to do Doomsday Plus One? Let me pause for a moment. I want to apologize to all the ladies in the room. Seriously, I'm about to tell something really filthy and disgusting, but it's funny. Nick Cuddy told this story. It's N-I-C-C-U-T-I, I think his name.
Co-creator of E-Man.
Yeah, and when he was drafted, his parents, trying to be professional, army guy people, sent him mail addressed to Cuddy Nicola, which was his full name, Cuddy. So he said, first day mail call, the sergeant's handing out mail, and he picks this up and looks at it, and, who the fuck is Cuddy Nicola? There you go. Doesn't mean anything, young person. Doesn't mean anything, trust me. I hadn't realized there was a kid in the room. Oh, I think of all my fans as being really old. Anyway, Nick tells that story, so I take no blame for it. But yes, somebody somewhere, save me. Yes.
How was your experience with Dark Horse and the Legends imprint?
Oh.
Those two different things.
They are kind of two different things.
Oh.
Joe Duffy, writer at Marvel, summed up Legend perfectly when she said it didn't take long for Legend to become myth. It sort of crashed and burned pretty fast. The Dark Horse experience was mostly good. The one thing I used to complain about was I said they had really great fixing damage. They could fix things that were wrong perfectly, brilliantly, overnight. But they couldn't actually stop things from going wrong. They didn't have damage control, they had damage correction. And that used to make me nuts. For example, my favorite, one of the X-Men paperbacks, trade paperbacks, is dedicated to Mark Grunewald, who had just died. And if you look at it, it's a small elliptical piece of paper that's been pasted in that says dedicated to Mark Grunewald. That's because what's actually printed on the page is dedicated to Mike Grunewald. And I saw the proofs of that and I said, you've got people working there who don't know who Mark Grunewald is? Oh my God.
And also they spelled Grunewald right, but not Mark?
Yeah, I think they spelled Mark with a C. Yeah, but that's semi kind of almost ironic, I guess, because Mark used to, his name was Mark, and he hated it when people called him, Marcus or something like that. And yet he was the guy who every single name of the characters always got, when we were doing the handbook, they always got stretched out. So I had a character, Smart Aleck, ALC, and then the handbook, it's his real name is Alexander. And I said, no, his real name is Alec. Like Alec Guinness, that's a name. That's an actual name. But, oh, I could go on about all these. Working in comics, a lot of fun. But it's also the death of a thousand cuts. There's always little things. So, what are you going to do? Sir?
In the era that you worked in, there was a lot of other legends that are in your caliber. Were there some contemporaries that whose work that you really respected amongst the...
No, I thought they were all guy. I was doing a mini interview on the Sci-Fi Channel with Walt Simonson, and the guy asked us if we were pals and whatnot. And we both said, no, we hate each other. But yeah, I mean, I used to be really good buddies with Frank Miller. I don't know what happened, but while we were both doing our stuff, while I was doing the FF and Alpha Flight, and he was doing Daredevil, we'd be talking to each other all the time and being subversive, in our own ways. And Walt and I are just pretty good buddies. I tell a story about when I was just starting out, been in the business about a year. Walt and Wheezy took me out to dinner. And I said at one point, I'm going to have to apologize for every stupid thing I'm going to say because I'm sitting here just trembling because I'm having dinner with Walt Simonson and, as it was then, Louise Jones. And Wheezy said, but we're having dinner with John Byrne. And that's Wheezy's mutant power. She could just go, whoom, when she was the editor on the Fantastic Four, on the X-Men. And Chris would piss me off, and I'd call her up and go, and she'd go, oh, but does it really matter? And I go, no. That's her mutant power.
So among other sort of legends and luminaries, you've written for, like, people think of you as a writer-artist, but you've written for some other big artists, Jim Aparo and...
Yeah.
I'm just curious, who did you most like to write for?
Oh, well, yes, working with J.R. Jr. was amazing. He is so good. God damn him. I'd like to break his hand. And I defined the John Romita Jr. moment when we were doing Iron Man together. And, by the way, parenthetically, go and take a look at those issues. Because he told me that he hates Iron Man. Go and look at those issues and say, what would he have done if he loved Iron Man? Holy crap. But there was a scene, ordinary scene, takes place in like the high council presidium of the Red Chinese government. They're all standing around talking about stuff. And as I wrote it, and I said, then the Mandarin steps into the room and starts doing something. And the way JR drew it was a giant Mandarin steps down through the ceiling. It's like everything I asked for, he gave me 347% more. And it was astonishing. He's just so good. He's just so good. And it, unfortunately, it was not really fair to poor Paul Ryan, who, when JR left abruptly, Howard Mackey hired Paul Ryan. Paul is one of those solid, dependable artists, but not terribly innovative. So following JR, it was like, you know, and if he'd been following anybody else, it would have been fine, but he was following JR.
I mean, let's also note, Paul Ryan had to follow the great John Byrne on Fantastic Four, too.
Well, he did. And he did it longer than I did.
Yeah.
That's great, spelled G-R-A-T-E.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been a fan for since your Captain America run. Thank you again for coming to Toronto. I appreciate it.
Oh, hey, I got to be somewhere.
when I found out, I thought I got to be here. And I was in your lineup on Friday for your book signing, and just talking to a couple of folks. It was amazing to see the passion that so many people had. That,
oh, yeah.
I didn't know that it was, you know, other than just me.
Fantastic.
I'm just wondering what you're thinking when you look out to a huge crowd like that and a room like this.
I mean, why isn't it bigger? Where are my true fans? I'll tell you the most amazing thing about, well, yeah, we're in Toronto, so we're all public. But you know what happened to me today? I was having a perfectly normal conversation with someone, and I said, well, that's the way it is, eh? oh my God. It took me 2 years to get rid of A when I moved to the, it really did. It was like, when I moved to the States, every time I said A, it was like, amusing little story off to the side. My now ex, but then my new wife, and the two stepchildren were in a McDonald's in Chicago. Snow on the ground, people wearing parkas. And I said, look at this. This could be in Calgary. If McDonald's are the same everywhere, there's snow, this, but I know that I'm not in Canada. Why do I know that I'm not in Canada? I can sense it. And a guy at the next table leans over and says, can you pass the salt? And I'm, there it is. The background noise, the ambience is going har 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 instead of ooh 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 ooh. It didn't have the round sound of the Canadian accent. And that was so funny. I did ask people years later if they had to beat the Canadian accent out of me, but apparently not. Having British parents and watching a lot of Canadian TV, I didn't do a lot of out in the boat. And Bill Shatner tells a story. When he was first trying to get work in the States, and people would say, no, we can't use you, because you say open the boat and host. And he literally walked the shoes, the leather off the bottom of his shoes, so he went to a shoe repairman, and you guys work on the bills waiting. And the guy says, you're from Canada, huh? And Bill says, yes. You know how I know? Yes, because I say open the boat and host. And he says, no, because he says made in Canada.
Down to like the last 3-4 minutes, so let's try to something brilliant behind Mark.
Are you able to tell us anything about the nature and the origin of your interesting relationship with William Shatner and how that developed?
Well, it turns out I did this photo novel, this Star Trek photo novel series, and it turns out he saw it and he liked it, and he wanted to help promote it. He wanted to help promote it. Exactly the moment I was stopping doing it, but that's okay. And he asked for this omnibus edition to be prepared so that he could sign it at cons. My understanding is he wants to sign it at cons even if I'm not there. You know, when I'm signing myself.
Cool.
So yeah.
I mean, was joking that that's the first comic book likeness of Captain Kirk that Will Shatner has ever approved of.
Although, IDW sent me Paramount's list of approved likenesses, people who have signed off on their likenesses and people who haven't. It was kind of a surprising list. And there were a number of people who wanted to see whatever was done, they wanted to see it for approval. And I mentioned this to a friend of mine, Paul, that they want to see everything. And he said, but it's photographs. You know, why would they? And I said, Paul, mirrors don't work the same way in Hollywood as they do in the rest of the world, okay? They see something different. But, so far, you know, with the 24 issues I did, I didn't have any answer. But it was very, very strange. I don't know how many of you followed the book, but there were a couple of background characters, like Mr. Leslie, who would be always the guy who was at the helm when Sulu wasn't there, you know, or he'd be in engineering. And he, over the years, he became a real character with a real name. Can't use him because he didn't sign off on the use of his likeness. Mm. And I said, God, he's in so many episodes. I could build a whole issue around Leslie, you know, the way I built a whole issue around Chekhov, which Walter Koenig loved, Kane loved, by the way. I thought that was great that he read it. And he said, oh, yes, that's true. You do a dramatic reading of this thing. That's what I forgot to ask Bill to do. Would you give me a dramatic reading? I'll be charging him $10,000. He gave me a Denny Crane. Yeah. And I owe him a Batman drawing for the Denny Crane.
All right, one last question.
One last brilliant question.
A lot of pressure.
But when you look back at your experience in Canada, particularly Calgary, what stands out with Google events?
I don't know, I think somewhere deep down inside me, I was always American. I have no problem with my Canadian background. I get kind of mad when people say, you're Canadian, right? And I say, lapsed.
That line plays way better when you do it if you go to
the way. Oh, yeah. No, but it's true. My father had a friend who was American, and he used to like give me American flags and American stamps and stuff, and it sort of poisoned my mind. I didn't vote for Trump.
So there you have it, folks. I hope you enjoyed the coverage that I've been able to deliver you from this year's Fan Expo Canada. I had a blast. I was so happy to be able to sit in on these panels with both Aaron Broverman from Speech Bubble Podcast, and then on Sunday with my good buddy Martin Slam Duncan from the Fastball Special Podcast, and to be able to ask as many questions as I did to John Byrne, who I'm a huge, huge fan of. And again, we'll never know when we'll be able to have him be at one of these cons to either meet him or to have a panel to hear him speak and, you know, share some of his history and stories and anecdotes that went into creating some of the greatest comic books of all time, really. So I've got plenty more coverage for you guys coming up in these next couple of episodes. Stay tuned. Don't forget to check us out on Facebook. Throw us a follow. Throw us a review on iTunes. And also don't forget to check out the podcast that I mentioned, both Speech Bubble and the Fastball Special. I definitely know Martin Slam Duncan is going to have some coverage from this year's Fan Expo Canada. And for the next episode, we're going to take a little bit of break from the panel coverage. And I'm going to hook you guys up with some of the interviews that I was able to conduct myself at this year's show. So we've got Casey Parsons, who was the cover artist and one of the main artists in the book Cauldron that you heard Shane Heron talk about on episode 130, as well as Marguerite Bennett, who is a DC Comics writer, Marvel Comics writer, works for Aftershock Comics, writing Animosity. And then, of course, we've got Jim Zub, who we know from Image Comics, from Samurai Jack, The Avengers, The Champions, local superstar, local legend, All around great guy. Those are the three interviews that we're going to have coming up for episode 132. So thank you everybody for listening. I am Eric Anthony, and stay tuned for more coverage coming your way very soon.